Blog Talk Radio.
Did you know there's a secret place to expand your mind? A place to escape the same old negative news? Welcome to Colombo Chronicles Live with Rose Colombo, award-winning author, cable TV and radio host, poet, and advocate for justice. Rose has been seen and heard on local and national TV and radio. She's consulted with victims of injustice for more than 20 years. Her articles have been published in major and local newspapers and magazines. Listen live as Rose Colombo welcomes prominent authors and experts to her podcast every Wednesday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific time at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles. You can call in and ask questions at 646-564-9742. Follow Rose Colombo every Wednesday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. on Colombo Chronicles Live at blogtalkradio.com/Colombo Chronicles.
Hi, everyone. This is the Rose, Rose Colombo, right here for you. It's Wednesday. It's June 5th, and we have a very special returning guest coming up very soon. So don't touch that dial. I'll be right back.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up, because we have a spectacular guest today. In fact, he's returning with his third book of his 30th century sci-fi trilogy, and his name is Dr. Mark Kingston Levin, and he is making AI's artificial intelligent heroes and integrates man's mistrust of AIs as well as of alien species. And in 30th Century Contact, the forthcoming additions to his stirring sci-fi series, 30th Century, Dr. Levin turns a common sci-fi storyline on its head. We saw how deadly a cyborg assassin can be when Arnold Schwarzenegger played one in the popular Terminator movie series. We read about the increasing problems with robots as they became more technologically advanced and intelligent in Isaac Asimov's best-selling book, Robot. We watched the AI running the spaceship turn against the crew in his classic film, 2001, A Space Odyssey. What if the author proposes the superior intellectual and other abilities of AIs could instead be harnessed to save humanity, and one AI program to be a bridge to first contact with alien species? Well, that's just a little tip of the iceberg, because Dr. Levin was born and grew up in Vermont with many winters spent in Florida as a child. And as a teenager, he wrote poetry, served as a lifeguard, and played football. He currently enjoys sailing, exploring underwater caves, snorkeling, writing science fiction, and other pursuits. But after working on the Apollo and Mars project, he decided to return to school to study under Nobel laureate Paul Dirac, obtaining his PhD in only 2.5 years. Dr. Levin founded two companies and served as a member of the science advisory team to President Ford, so I have to ask him about that. And he has published over 44 times in the scientific literature and was awarded over 32 U.S. patents. We'll ask him about that. The science fiction writer is now emerging with his third book, and he has written a trilogy of three books, 30th Century. And the first book is 30th Century Escaped, and then 30th Century Revised is what we're going to be discussing today. So let's say hello to Dr. Levin and get started with the information that he has on his third book. And congratulations, Dr. Levin, on completing your third book to your trilogy.
Well, thank you very much. I'm now working on the fourth book. So it's just one of those things you can't stop. So I'm going to make it a series. But I did find it a pretty satisfying ending of this book. But I wanted to say one or two things about why I write books and what really got me started. I heard about all these shootings. Now, this goes back a long time. And even in the 1800s, we had shootings in schools.
Right.
And I didn't find it satisfactory to have so many deaths. So these are kind of mass killers. They're trying to kill lots of people. They get famous, and they don't care about their life. That's a very sad thing, very sad. My book is about nonviolence, and all my books are about nonviolence. My heroine is nonviolent, and she saves terrorists that are going to be killed by, guess what, you know, our SEALs or our CIA send out people with the license to kill. So she finds out they're going to kill the terrorists, and she wants to bring them to justice under court and find out much more about their motives and stuff. Because she thinks that's the only way we can prevent future. And she's looking to, you know, patch things up with the Muslim world. And, you know, that's her way is a peaceful way. She wants to make things peaceful way. But in book two, she goes out and rescues the terrorists, brings them to Japan, well, gets them to Japan through a Japanese ship that's nearby. And, of course, the Japanese don't have a capital punishment. So that's why she does it. So, and she risks her life and life of her friend, who is Japanese, and they do it. And they take these guys in and eventually prosecute them through the court system, which is what people are supposed to do, including law officers. But the military sometimes has different charge. That's why they're military or paramilitary or, you know, the CIA is sometimes called different things, but they're an intelligence organization. They're not supposed to be killing people, but sometimes they do. But anyway, our job in nonviolence is to save people. We don't want people to die. So avoiding death of all kinds, just avoiding the violence. So she goes in a day early to get the people out. She does it. And she takes a lot of risks, but she's very committed to nonviolence. And that scene is to really show how committed she is to nonviolence. So in the first book, it's not so strong, but here it is. So that's part of my theme of my trilogy is to obtain nonviolent ways. A main character that's nonviolent hasn't happened in a major book, an award-winning book, since Isaac Asimov, 1952.
Well, I'm glad to hear that because there is so much violence that I try to avoid movies with too much violence, too much bloodshed, too much attacks on women and children and all of that because I think, you know, it's not a positive thing for us to have to watch and read and then come out of there and not have it affect us, especially children. So I'm very happy to hear that. And so what is the name of your key characters in your books?
Okay, Jennifer was named Jennifer Juniper LaVie, that was her birth name. And then when she went undercover, she saved the life in book one of a senator. He happens to be Sindo. And there's a fair amount of conflict between the Sindos and the humans. For the most part, they try to be nonviolent. At least the humans do. But the Sindos are drawing blood first. So they don't want to go to war because Jennifer is from a nonviolent organization called the SS, a secret society of scientists. It's a nonviolent organization headed by her lover. His name is Sexton Ho, and he's the inventor of time travel. And he's also a Nobel Prize winner. So he's a pretty sharp guy. Unfortunately, towards the end of book one, he is assassinated right in front of her. And she saved him twice from two assassination attempts. But this time, they had three assassins, each using a high-powered laser, which is, once you pull the trigger, it's instantaneous. And they hit him in the head from three sides, and there was no chance for her to save him. Anyway, that's a sad story for her, because this really disrupted her. They were together for 18 years since she was joined the she was recruited by him to come into the SS. And SS is normally only people whose parents are in the SS or are members of the original crew. And her grandfather was a member of the original crew. In fact, he was the director of it. And he invented the V7 virus, which doesn't hurt anybody, but they want to spread it to humans and Sindos, because it helps the Sindos get their moral compass. And it's genetic engineering. But most all of our genetic engineering, we use viruses as vectors. And the viruses are able to do things in every cell of our body. And they're able to change things. So it's not that simple. I wish it was. But basically, the virus is the vector. So V7 is to make one small change to the Sindos, and it does it effectively, yes.
Does your character, when she falls in love, does that create a problem for her as far as her mission goes?
I think it does. I think she's pretty much burned out, and she's not perfect. And so when she should be leading her team, but when they go, she goes to the 21st century. She is a historian first and an archaeologist second. And then third, they make her the leader of the SS, which she thinks is too much. She's having trouble handling it all. She's a little bit burned out. So she appoints her best friend and former lover to be the leader, take over. And she plans it out. She knows, and she pretends that the thing has failed, the autocorrect had failed, and that she had to do it manually, and she sent them off. And she went to 2015. It's actually a good thing, because she gets really confused, and she's about to goes into a severe depression, because her DNA was identified as the person who lived and was born in the Marquesas Islands, which are about 780 miles from Tahiti, and they're northwest. And then Moaroa is the island where the time machine is on, and it's about 1,000 miles south of 790 miles south of Tahiti. We'll keep one point reference. I don't want to give you too many points of reference. So it's south. The Marquesas are north, and Tahiti is a pretty much central part of French Polynesia. It's the capital of French Polynesia. So from a point of view, it's got everything, airports and all kinds of supplies and research facilities, universities. It has everything. It's a little bit like Hawaii was in the 1960s, but nowhere near the population. It's growing. It's growing very rapidly. And even today, it's growing. Where most of the other islands, for example, take the Marquesas, there's as many Marquesans who live in Tahiti that live in the Marquesas. So it's a very attractive to other islands, other island groups, mm-hmm. because they can get good jobs there.
So tell us about, in your 30th century trilogy here, what are the gravity waves and what does their detection relate, and how does their detection relate to the 30th century trilogy?
Okay, well, 30th century trilogy, at first we developed, or I'm not saying I am, I developed the characters in my book, which includes Jennifer, developed a artificial intelligence that becomes a part of a spaceship that has to be very heavy, okay, because it has to impact one of they have two neutron stars that are orbiting each other, and they're going to collide. And they're going to form a single unit, which it's almost like a black hole, but it will emit from the collision a beam of particles and photons that will destroy the Earth and Mars, because they're going to be in alignment at that time. So what she does is develop this robot, not by herself, but with the 56th century. She goes for help. She says, we got to go to the future. Those people really care because they got 100 years and they live for 1,000 years. So, and in the 30th century, they live for 800 years. So they go there and ask for help. And first they get put in prison, but eventually they go and check out what they claim, and they come back and it's true, and they are so grateful that they make Jennifer co-director of the program to develop this artificial intelligence. It's her idea to use Vesta and to collide it, and she's very good at engineering, so she figured this out. And she thought they would be very interested. So she did. You know, they had to be in prison for a while, and then they finally went to find out, and they were right. And so the 56th century, you know, they have less than 100 years to live, and they're very grateful as well. And that gives her, I think, kind of restores her self-esteem, her pride, because she, she kind of ducked out of them. The competition, but they do the job without her, and they get it done. They get the virus spread out pretty much through everybody, the whole population, because they put it in bottled water, and also have contacted personally, but individually made contact with each of the Sindos, because they're just children at this time. And they have no resistance to or any suspicion. And they become, some coaches and janitors and things, and are able to, meet the people, shake their hands, and that's enough to transfer the virus. But as the virus is transferred, that's the early part of book three, pretty much, a part of book three.
Because in book three, you say she has a twin sister, and
yes.
And that she learns about the destruction of Earth in the 57th century. So how does Jenny know all of this?
Well, she, her father was from the 32nd century, and he came back to the 30th century to live because he met a woman there. And that sometimes happens, And but he was very much an adventurer. And one of his brothers wanted to continue the business. And they went to the 21st century to do some good, okay, to spend some money and give donations and set up foundations and a few things like that. But let's go back to the third book. The third book starts off with Jenny finding out 57th century, she's going exploring on her own, because essentially it's her joy, right? She does, you know, she's not supposed to go, but she went, and then she comes back, tells her sister. Her sister stops her from shaking and tells her, we'll get it. She has a lot of confidence, but she also wants her sister to be useful. And if you're not calm, you're not useful. So, and they go, and they successfully develop this artificial intelligence. They call it Vesta. Okay. Now Vesta has to go back in time in order to hit this on time, and she needs 489 years. They go back about 5,000 years because they can only travel at 10% the speed of light. This is a very long journey, and when you're going very long journeys, you have to go with a technology that is comparable, okay, that will work for that for 5,000 years. So only a very advanced, intelligent robot can regenerate parts of itself and do all this thing. Now, on the way, the robot, Vesta, makes a copy of itself or reproduces itself, and there's no sex, but it's just making a copy of itself, and then
That's
sends
weird.
This... Yeah. Well, you know, robots can make themselves, but they don't do it by sexual means. They do it
right.
by construction. Well, it gets a lot of mass when it travels that far, 5,000 years at 10% the speed of light. It acquires the mass. When it gets enough mass, it trains its child for 27 years. Because remember, it had a lot. It's going to arrive quite a bit early. Anyway, and then it sends it back and wants it to go find Jennifer, because Jennifer was Vesta's parent, okay? And she was brought up, adopted parent, but parent. And she was co-director, and the other co-director was a male, and it was, like the adopted father. And it worked out pretty well. It went back. It got attacked by Earth because Earth thought it was the Vesta, original Vesta, not Vesta 2. But Vesta 2 goes back, gets attacked, but it has 56th century technology, which is enough to deflect the weapons, and it survives. But it has the aliens in it. On its way back, it finds these aliens. And one of the tasks its parent gave it was to try to help other races communicate. All life forms are what you call holy in the sense, not in so much in the religious sense, but in the sense that it's Vesta's job to preserve them. Preserve life and exchange life and culture. So it picks up 22 aliens, takes them to Earth, and it gets attacked not by the Earth government, which says we're going to go to do intelligence first. We're not going to just go attack. But there's another group on Earth that is they have a trigger. They're not nonviolent. There's another group on Earth that tends to solve problems by violence, or it wants to, and they're not in the majority in terms of countries, but they're a majority in terms of population. The Indian and Chinese governments represent half the population, so they think we have the right to do it, and they do it. They attack. They don't succeed, but they attack for several days. They continue the attacks, and it's to show that there is violence in the world, and we have to sometimes work around it. But fortunately, Vesta 2 has force fields to prevent the attack. And it's next big mission. It really is the first contact to deliver the aliens and serve as a platform for the aliens to communicate while they're biologically isolated, which they'll be for at least 1 year. So during this period of time, Vesta 2 becomes, it doesn't want to be a leader or get into politics. No, it wants to help humanity do things nonviolently. And this is a good thing. And eventually, that's the road. I don't want to do any spoilers, but it takes a road, and and it wants to head for Zinnia. Not only to take what happens is Zinnians all die except for the two that are not supposed to go there. They're in isolation and they have to go back and report. But the 20 die. But towards the end, Vesta 2 brings them back to life. They were frozen, and once Vesta 2 has a cure, it brings them back to life and cures them. And they now worship Vesta 2. Vesta 2 doesn't want to worship. And that's just to show you what's on the agenda, that they're being worshipped, and because they Vesta 2 brought them back to life, and that's kind of a big thing. And most they're not primitive. The population is probably about 2015 equivalent of it's now in the 30th century, but in 2015, they're about like that, where Earth is, a couple of years ago. They're learning a lot more as we go.
So in your book, you say, though, that, that AIs reproduce themselves. And so, do they have children, or how would they have children?
Well, they are children. That's when they reproduce themselves.
Oh, they're all children.
Mentally. Yeah.
Oh, mentally.
Mentally, they're children. They have to be brought up. It takes the father spent, or not the father, but the parent, AI, Vesta, spent 27 years, of course, out of 5,000, with the child, and then the child headed back. Okay. Because he's on a long, they're on a long mission, and he has to get there. But he wanted to train his child, because he was trained by his mother, adopted mother was Jennifer, adopted father was Dr. Greco from the 56th century. So we do get into the 56th century. And they are much more advanced than than the 30th century, or any other time. And it's really good that they are, because now the robots are protected, and are helping. Main job is to help humanity become more nonviolent and become more civilized.
That sounds like a movie. It sounds like a great movie. I mean, seriously, I was listening to you, and a movie was going through my head as you were.
Oh, well, that's good.
I could picture it, and it would be very exciting to see it on the big screen, in my opinion.
Well, I have a company interested. It's called Coffee Stain Films, and they have already written one script for book one.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so it started, but they have to raise a lot of money to make it all happen. Because when you're doing this, you're raising money is a big thing, and that's all the young, great film writers struggle to get money. Even in the most famous one of all, what's his name? He was, well, I'm stuck on it. But anyway, even the greatest directors who did Jaws and E.T. and just many other great films, he struggled in the beginning to get enough money or get somebody to back him. You know, like the big film studios, you notice when you see a film, you see this studio, then also this studio, and maybe also this studio. The reason is they want to share the risk.
Right, because it's, I mean, if you look at the, you know, the credits, I mean, they go on forever and ever. There's so many people involved in a movie that it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so people think, oh, they just throw this movie together. You write a book and they'll just make a movie. But it doesn't work like that. And it takes a lot of effort and work for the producers and directors and everybody else to dig up the money to make the movie and take the risk, right?
And they want these special effects, all these special effects things. And doing those, it costs a lot of money to put it all together. And then the advertising, you have to have a tremendous amount of advertising to get a successful movie. So the people in the business know what it is. You know, the people in the business.
You may have the greatest book on earth, but I mean, seriously, you know, I mean, you have to have somebody that believes in it, will go with it, you know, and make it happen.
Right.
And then you have the actors who depends on which actor you want, you know, that will charge,
We want a very good actor, but I have some conflict with my cohorts who are working with me on the film, because they want to make, Dexton Ho is Chinese, but they want to make him Caucasian and just use makeup. You can get that famous guy to do it, I think, you know, maybe it's, you know, they've done it before, maybe this is something good. I don't know. But, you know, that's above me. That's what I tell them. I would stick to, you know, Chinese guy. But there are many good Chinese actors. But anyway, they...
But they can. The makeup artist can make you look any which way they want, believe me.
Yeah, well, they can. They can make you look like a dinosaur, you know. They can do anything. They can do anything today. It's amazing. But, you know, it's very expensive. But when you've got to have a great movie. And and then you've got to sell it. What they do, what's called testing. You know, they test it.
Mm-hmm.
They'll make a film, pilot. Yeah, not a full film, but they'll make something, and they'll show it to an audience somewhere, and see how they like it, and then interview them afterwards. You know, interview the people, how they like it, what we could do better, all that type of thing. So it's, you know, just filming doesn't mean that, you know, it's ready for marketing. Because when they do marketing, they spend, you know, millions and millions of dollars of marketing before you hit the market with it. That's what makes a successful film. First of all, you have to have good actors. That's the number one.
Right.
You know, and you got good actors, and then you got to do these things. So I didn't want to take all your time talking about film because I don't know anything about it. I'm just one of these poor guys who gets to talk to some of the film people.
No, that's okay because, you know, I mean, while you were talking, as I said, I could see it in a movie, you know, that people would thoroughly enjoy and come away with a good feeling because – you know, it's taking away from the glorifying violence, and I think people are ready for that. I think I think the fads change as the every 10 years or so. People are like, okay, we've had enough of that. Let's move on to this. You know.
Well, I hope so.
I mean, the timing could be like really, really good, is what I'm saying.
I want the children to see nonviolence as nonviolent heroes as just as important as violent heroes, or more important.
Exactly.
And that's
I think.
Yeah. So that's what I was trying to do, and I guess these guys are from Notre Dame, but I mean they graduated a few years back. But anyway, they graduated from Notre Dame. They have a pretty good program. They're 18th academically in their category. They're 18th. It's pretty high rating. I went to University of Miami, and they were 50, rated 50. And anything less than 100 was thought to be good. Anyway, I was right in the middle. So, I wasn't thinking of, I did have also an opportunity to go to Brown to study mathematics, applied mathematics there, but I chose to study with Dirac, he, in my opinion, was the top living scientist at the time, and he was amazing. I'm just honored that I had a chance to work with him. I became friends, and it wasn't just 2.5 years. We became friends after I got my PhD. Then we spent time sailing together. He would jump in the water in the middle of January, dive in the water. I shouldn't say jump. He would dive, and he was pretty good at doing it. He enjoyed it. He enjoyed it. He said, "The water's 65 degrees. In the middle of summer, it doesn't get that warm in England."
Well, I think it's amazing how people, don't realize that, just taking action and doing something like you did to be under his wing for 2.5 years, end up being friends and leaving good memories in your mind that you can share with other people, and without even realizing what's going to happen just by taking positive actions. I think that's really great, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. And so you founded two companies and served as a member of the science advisory team to President Ford. What was that like, and what did you do?
Well, I did a couple of things, but the first thing was IRDA. In other words, energy was all over the place, and it was all controlled by the Atomic Energy Commission. Okay, and I thought that wasn't good. I thought we had to have solar. We had to have other means that were a bigger portion of the budget, So I multiplied the budget by 10 times for the solar program. I wasn't doing it all by myself. I had a guy named Paul Donovan. He was the real energy czar, okay? He was the energy czar. He was very much for these things and a very positive guy. And one of the closest friends I also had, and he's up in Santa Cruz. I used to be up in the Bay Area, and we were used to socialize together and go sailing together and go out and look at the this wildlife. Just watch it, and it was fun. He was a fun guy. A few years ago, he wanted me to go with him to Tahiti. No, Hawaii. I wasn't quite ready to do that because I had a job. I had stock shareholders, and I had all this stuff. But I had that. I was in that job, the last job, for 32 years. Okay. One of the reasons is that most of the funding came from me. The first company I did very well in, but I didn't control it. And I was a CTO. And eventually, just before the sale, in other words, a part of the sale, I became CEO. They wanted to keep me there for 2 years. And I agreed to it. And they paid me. They paid me if I hit a number, I was going to get more stock, and twice as much stock as I had already. And that was pretty good. And I liked that. So I agreed to it, and I worked with them for 2 years. And then I went back into another world, and business is totally different, and you have a lot of responsibilities. You have to do your fiduciary responsibility and look out for your investors.
Right.
And of course, in my first company, you know, I wasn't a majority player, so I had less responsibility, but I still agreed to stay with the company so it wouldn't crash. And, the company was in a good growth mode. We had a very rapid growth. We were basically doubling every 2 years. So that was pretty phenomenal. But, you know, we were at $16 million, and not $16 billion. But, I mean, big companies have a hard time growing like that. It's just you've saturated the market. Once you hit the market, you can't get any bigger. I mean, once the market grows, you have to wait for market growth. So, yeah, but when you're very small and you're doing military, you know, one contract, like usually the minimum contracts are around $5 million. So if you get one for 10 or 12 or 16, that's a good business. But our business was not just one contract. We had Air Force contracts. We had Navy. We had Army. We had, Coast Guard? But we had all the services. We did Coast Guard. We did search and rescue models. So we worked, you know, in a little bit in almost every area of the military. And DARPA was probably the biggest one when we first started. But, you know, the first one was $2 million. It was a DARPA. It was a paper study, you know. And then when we did the paper study, it went real well. They moved next. And then the Navy took over. So DARPA does things very preliminary, you know what I mean? But that will have big impact. That will have a big impact later on. And their job really is to turn it over to another service. They're supposed to be doing things for all the military services. And that's how we kind of got into a broader, you know, program. We got search and rescue for the Coast Guard and the Navy. We did the sensors for trying to find submarines under the ice, and also for temperature and salinity. So we had quite a bit there, and then we did the ISAFE laser radar for the Army. Yeah. And so that's about
you. People were very intelligent to do what you did.
I had a lot of good people with me. You know,
exactly.
I was a CTO, but I had very good people. One guy named Peter Naylor, who is now at Scripps, he was at University of Miami there then. And when I worked with him, and then when he came here, I also worked with him for a while here, but it was on a totally different thing, but with my second company. The first company, he worked there. So it's kind of strange how people follow you or I follow them. I don't know. But when I started my second company, I actually started it in the Bay Area up in I lived in Tiburon, and I was at the university, close to the University of California, Berkeley. And because I was doing a lot of work with a person at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, okay? And so to use his computers and stuff, because I did a lot of computer work. I was a theorist, and I did a lot of computer work with models and simulations and stuff. So that's what we were doing, and it brought in money in the very beginning. We needed the government money to get started, and that's how we did it. We worked with Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and we kept working with them even when we moved down here. I moved from the Bay Area down to La Jolla in 1982. Okay, so.
La Jolla is beautiful.
Yeah, La Jolla is beautiful, yeah. I now live in Del Mar. I moved, it was a good move. And the main thing I needed was, I had my factory in Sorrento Valley, and I wanted to be somewhere where when I was in Northern California, it was very difficult to hire college graduates and then pay them enough money to be able to live there. the Bay Area was at that time much more expensive. So I moved down here and in the San Diego area, and it worked out very well because at the time, San Diego wasn't growing that fast, and there were plenty of places to live nearby within a half an hour drive, not an hour and a half drive like it was in the Bay Area. They could afford to live here, and as they did better, the company did better, they could get more money, and you know they would move, get promoted, and then they could live in La Jolla if they needed to. So some of them. All of them got promoted to that kind of position, but I had good people. And they were just good, and that's what makes a company successful.
That's what the all American capitalism, free enterprise world does, and how people can, you know, be so adverse to it amazes me. So you are an example of what you can do if you want to do it and be proactive, and become successful as you are. And so you published over 44 times in the scientific literature, and you were awarded over 32 U.S. patents. That's amazing. What is your favorite patent?
Well, it's actually 33 now.
Okay, I'll change that.
Okay. So I got lucky. What I did is, whatever I needed, we did market research. I had a friend of mine who was educating me a little bit because he'd been around for a while. His name is Joe Stemler. He was an advisor of mine, and he's an amazing guy. He did several medical companies on his own, but he was just an advisor to me. But he told me to find out what the market is. He did that in medicine. He found out what was needed. And so when you make it, you succeed, it's going to sell. You got to make something that's a big market. And so I think that's what I did. I went there to find the big markets, and we found one. We made it. There wasn't a really big market at the time, but I was a president of a non-profit organization called Carbon Monoxide Safety and Health Association, and that organization got all the states basically to require carbon monoxide detectors. I invented the detector, and I blundered because there was no market for it at the time, but then I said, well, I have to create the market, and my advisor said, no, nobody spends the time to create a market. I said, well, if you make it a requirement, then you can do it. Because you can't educate people, you know, it just doesn't work. Because you don't have enough money to do it, for one thing. They're not going to listen to you anyway, even if you're a nonprofit organization. So we went to the regulators, got the regulators in Chicago to require CO detectors, and that was the start. And then there were several other cities that did it, and then the states did it. But getting the states to do it was the answer to create the market, because once the states require it, then all of them are, maybe not all of them, but at least the majority of the U.S. market in terms of volume are pretty much committed. I mean, it wasn't very long before, you know, almost every state in the union required it. Alaska did it right away. Utah. I mean, you know, states that you normally don't think of as being, but safety is not Democrat or Republican. And I wanted to stress that there is no difference. It may be that the first people who lined up, the first state, okay, was Virginia, and then Rhode Island. West Virginia, very unusual, be the first state. But 10 people died in one family in that year. And the kids that survived and their classmates actually wrote the bill and gave it to the Democrats and Republicans equally, you know.
Oh, wow.
So Yeah. I thought that was a wonderful story. That they wanted to do something. They wanted to do something because, you know, all these, this family died, you know. I think they had 12 kids in the family, and 10 of them died. Two of them were away for some reason. I can't remember why. But so the two survivors and then their classmates got together to write the bill. They wrote a bill. I gave them some advice, but I said, you have to write your own bill. But if you need any particular advice on something, I'm here. I'm a nonprofit, part of a nonprofit company. I did that for 10 years, nonprofit, headed that nonprofit organization. But by 10 years, it was all regulated already. It took 10 years. And I said, I let somebody else take over for me. His name was Uno, Mr. Uno. He was Japanese, and he had he worked for a Japanese company that made lots of different sensors. He was kind of a competitor to us. Yeah. So.
Yes. Sometimes it takes a tragedy in order to bring a solution to a problem that people didn't realize was even there. And God puts people in certain places at certain times, and it's supposed to be the way it is. And this is what I believe what happened to you, that you were in the right place at the right moment in time, and people were proactive, and look what happens. So on your first book, 30th Century Escape, and then 30th Century Revised, your second book was 30th Century Contact, and then 30th Century Revised. Did I get that mixed up?
Contact is the third book.
I'm sorry.
I really talk about them, you know, because they're all 30th Century. I talk about them. Escape, Revived, and Contact.
I mixed up the second and third there.
In my fourth book now, we're going off to see the Zinnians, spelled with an X, by the way, Zinnian. And it's Zinnia, the planet's name is Zinnia. Anyway, the people on it are Zinnians. But they have horns and they have things coming down their back that are kind of like fins. So they're a little different than us, but, you know, they're emotionally very much like us. You know, they have a need for being recognized for their work and things like that. So they're emotionally a lot like us, but they're different physically.
You just reminded me quickly about, you know, how you said people are the same as us with feelings and all that, but they look different. And so, of course, you know, we judge books by their cover, and they either, you know, we either shun away from them or we welcome them into our lives, whichever. But you reminded me real quickly, I saw on a video yesterday, a rhino who some men came along and stole his horn. And the veterans were trying to heal him and keep him alive and all that. And they had his head covered and they were putting medication or whatever and massaging him. And as they zoomed in, they showed his eye and he was actually crying and tears were coming from his eyes. And that just really touched me. I mean, I've never seen such a moment with a wildlife animal who has been harmed, you know, and injured to that degree, and he was actually crying. And so, yeah, so you just reminded me of how you were saying they have fins and they look different than we do, and, you know, but they feel they have the same feelings and da-da-da. And I think that's important about your books. I like your books. I mean, they have human interest and human feelings, and then they have a desire to bring peace into the world and help people to, you know, become united instead of fighting each other. I think this is so exciting, and I think it's so timely too. So, unfortunately, Dr. Levin, we're always, running out of time. And but now is your time to shine, and it's your moment to tell us anything you want about yourself, about your how they can contact you or your social media, and about your books.
Okay. My web is markkingston11.com. Mark Kingston 11, that's my website, markkingston11.com. And my email, if they want to contact me, is markkingston11@gmail.com. And that's markkingston11@gmail.com. That's my email. If they want to contact me directly, I'll be very happy to answer them. If they can mention Rose Colombo, then I'll be sure to remember how you came to contact me, and I appreciate it. Want to say that you can buy on Amazon. It is probably cheaper there than other places, but it's not a big difference. If you're an ebook person, you can get these books around $2, $3, depending on which one it is and how big it is. The printed books are a bit more expensive. Some are over $25. But what I used to sell in terms of books on physics, some of them used to sell for $500. And that's many years ago when I was a professor. So it seemed like a lot more money then. But it really isn't that.
It's still a lot more money to a lot of people today.
Yeah. But not many people want to buy them, and the people who want to buy them need to buy them. So it's like, you know, you have a small market. You're not going to sell it to people who haven't gotten these kind of graduate books, like on quantum mechanics or astronomy, some of those types of things, which are very narrow, because mm-hmm. when you have to go after a target, it's very narrow. Some of this fields of, and therefore, just first year graduate school, of course, your market is not very big. So in order to get back enough for the publisher to be interested, you got to charge this price and you can get it. I mean, at least we got it in those days. I don't know about today, because they got the internet now and they can buy it on ebooks. And then it's much cheaper. It's the print, all the color. Every page has color on it, because you're trying to show graphs and diagrams and all that type of thing, and it's expensive. But yeah, when you think about it, what you're paying for a college degree, it's not that expensive, because even the state universities, which are relatively cheap because they're paid by taxpayers, need textbooks, and they have to recommend them, and they have to get some, and people aren't writing them, then your textbooks get way behind. And I think they are today, because we have the ebook, most people are happy with ebooks. The price may be less than $100 for an ebook, and $500 something for a textbook. Many people today are happy to work with a computer. It's all in their computer, and they don't have to have this big book to carry around. So it's a different world. That's why probably nobody's writing these books anymore. They're still using my book in some schools. Yeah. So that I wrote in, 1976. Yep. That's when it was published, finally. I wrote it. It took me about 3 years to write it, because I had, I had to give courses, and I couldn't find any good textbooks. So that's why I wrote the book. When I was in that phase of my life, it was very important to me. I wanted to have a good textbook. Today, you don't need it so much, because there's so much information out there, and it's so cheap to get ebooks.
Right.
And I'm in favor of it. I read only ebooks myself. I do read a lot of science fiction. I love science fiction, and I still read it. I remember I read The Martian, Andy Weir, when he was not famous, when he was trying to give away, chapters and on the internet, and he couldn't get it published. I don't know what was wrong, because after he got his movie, he got it published. And he said, that's the best way to sell books, is get the movie first. He had Matt Damon on the cover. And books sell by the cover. Yeah,
and that's so that true. Was
Amazing. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah,
I was so
amazing.
Happy to see that.
So how can, before we sign off here, how can they get your book? Your books?
Well, they can go to Amazon in the window and type in Mark Kingston Levitt.
Okay.
And
perfect.
And just click on it. It will come to, and then when you click on that, it'll come to the first page, and then you have to go to the second page to get all the details. There's two pages, but you just click on the book in the first page, and it'll take you to the second page, and then you can
buy it.
So it's relatively easy for people, and remember, it's only a little over maybe $3 or something like that, because there's some tax. I think it's $2.99 for the most recent book, but $1.99 for the older book, and I think it's 99 cents sometimes on sale for the third book. So,
fantastic.
So that's how they can do it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Kingston Levin. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. We're looking forward to the fourth book now. And sorry I mixed up the second and third books, but you corrected me.
No problem.
And 30th Century is all they have to remember, right?
Yeah,
Amazon.com. And your name. Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure always speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
You're
welcome.
Bye-bye. Bye. And Dr. Mark Kingston Levin, L-E-V-I-N, has left the building, a scientist, an author, and he's the inventor of 33 U.S. patents, worked for the government, Dr. Ford. You want to read about him, and you can Google his name. You can also go to Amazon.com to get his trilogy. He's working on his fourth book, as he said, and he's published over 44 times in the scientific literature. And you can, if you're confused about anything, you can always email him at markkingstonlevin@gmail.com and tell him the Rose said hello. And thank you for listening in, and we'll talk to you again next Wednesday. God bless you. God bless America. God bless the President of the United States and all our leaders, and may they make great decisions today and always for you and for the United States of America. So stay healthy, stay happy, and remember, the Rose loves you too. Bye-bye.
Rose Colombo is signing off, and she's left the building. Be sure to bookmark and share Colombo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. on the West Coast. Or if you're sleepless in the big city, that would be 11 to midnight on the East Coast. Rose Colombo says, remember, you're never alone when you tune in every Wednesday to Colombo Chronicles.